Now, in a black and white film, a logo of a lion appears, framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. In a large grassy field, an old man with a dog herds a flock of sheep. They walk past a man on a tractor plowing near a stately two-story manor. Inside, in a library, a gray-haired man wears a jacket and an ascot. He walks past a wall lined with books, then bends to pet a white German shepherd lying in front of a roaring fireplace. He crosses the room to a large wooden desk and picks up a phone.
Good morning. Would you get me Major Berners at his White Hall number? Thank you.
Hanging up, the man strolls over to a window by a baby grand piano and gazes out at the countryside.
Hello? Thank you.
Alan?
It's Gordon. Look, you're coming down here today, aren't you? Could you pick up a book for me and bring it with you? It's...
Gordon's eyelids grow heavy and he drops the phone. His limp body falls to the floor. The dog lies unmoving by the fire. Now in Alan's office.
Gordon? Operator? Operator? Still blasted. Got cut off. That was my brother-in-law. Would you try and get through again? I've got to go and change.
Yes, sir.
Alan wears a British officer's uniform.
Operator? We've been cut off from Midwich 2-5. Would you get it again, please?
Hello? Hello? Will you replace your receiver, please?
In the library, the phone receiver dangles near Gordon's outstretched body.
Hello?
Outside, the tractor driver slumps face down against the steering wheel, riding in a large circle over the newly plowed ground. The tractor heads toward a small tree growing in the field. It knocks the tree down, then stops. Now, on a road lined with houses, bodies lie motionless on the ground. A driver hangs out the window of a wrecked truck as an older man leans against a wooden bench. Another villager stands propped over a box. A sign on a building reads, Post Office and General Stores. Another sign, You may telephone from here. Inside, an operator sits draped over a switchboard. A few feet away, a plump, white-haired woman lies still amid groceries strewn across the floor. In a room behind her, a sink overflows with water. In a small dining room, smoke rises from an iron pressed against a dress on an ironing board. A middle-aged woman lies sprawled on the floor below. A teenage girl reclines on a couch beside a Victrola record player. Outside a row of brick townhouses, a man and woman lie flat on a dirt road by a village green. Across the green stands a church with a stone steeple. A clock in the steeple reads 11. Titles appear over the clock. George Sanders as Gordon Zellaby and Barbara Shelley as Anthea Zellaby in Village of the Damned. Copyright 1960, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Incorporated. This film has been described by Descriptive Video Service, a division of the Media Access Group at WGBH, with funding by the U.S. Department of Education. Described by Beth Molden, read by Peter Haydu. For more about DVS, call 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website at dvs.wgbh.org. More titles. Michael Gwynn as Major Alan Bernard, Lawrence Naismith as Dr. Willers. Screenplay by Sterling Siliphant, Wolf Rilla, and George Barclay, based on the novel The Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. Produced by Ronald Kinnock. Directed by Wolf Rilla. Now in an office, a clock reads 12:15. A man wearing a general's uniform speaks with Alan.
A
For more than an hour, you say?
Yes, sir.
Perhaps something went wrong with his phone.
Ah, but this is what puzzles me, sir. You see, I've also tried the vicar, the general stores, and the post office. I can't get any reply from any of them.
Well, country telephone exchanges being what they are.
Yes, I know, sir, but well, look here, sir.
He points to a map.
Midwich is here. Our 4th Brigade are running that exercise of theirs all round it. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't suppose there is anything in it, sir, but I was wondering, as I was going down for the weekend anyway, whether I could have your permission to leave earlier than I intended.
All right, Alan. Give me a ring later. I shall be here till 5.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, Alan.
Yes, sir?
Have a nice weekend. Give my respects to Gordon.
I will. Goodbye, sir.
Alan leaves. The general arches his eyebrows as he looks at the map on the wall. Now, Alan speeds down a country road in a boxy white car with tail fins. Rounding a curve, he passes a heavy-set constable riding a bicycle. Alan stops and rolls down the window.
Hello, Gobby.
Oh, it's Major Bernard, sir.
Well, Gobby, what's happened to the telephones? I've been trying to get through all morning.
It's funny you should ask, Major. I've just been sent to look for the bus, which hasn't turned up. We can't get through by phone either.
Alan drives ahead. Gobby starts to pedal his bike. Stopping, Gobby's eyes narrow on the distance. Then he pulls up beside Alan, leaning out the driver's side window.
Here's your bus, Gobby.
It's truth. Better have a look.
At the side of the road, the bus rests nose first in a ditch. Gobby walks his bike toward the wreck. Then his knees buckle, and he falls to the ground. Alan ducks his head back into the car and closes the door. Turning around, he speeds off the way he came. Gobby lies flat on his back in the middle of the road, his arms splayed out. A few feet away, passengers on the bus slump motionless against the windows. Now in the general's office.
All right, Alan, you better get hold of the local area commander. What's his name?
Ward Johnson, sir.
Oh, yeah. Tell him to call me if he wants authorization. I'll get things moving this end. Oh, Alan.
Yes, sir?
Make sure the newspapers don't get hold of this for the time being. If anything has got out of hand there, we don't want any panic. Report back as soon as you have any results.
Right, sir.
The general turns on an intercom.
Get me Southeastern Command, please.
Later.
Over here, Sergeant!
On the country road, soldiers set up a military checkpoint. Two soldiers wearing berets unroll a line of wide ribbon over the street and across an adjacent field. Other soldiers post a sign reading, "Warning, military exercise." In the distance, the village bell tower rises above trees bordering a field. Later, two soldiers carry a long pole with a bird cage hanging from the end. Alan watches as they extend the cage toward Gobby's body. The bird falls lifeless, and they pull the pole back.
Look, the canary.
The canary hops up and shakes its feathers. Alan turns to a soldier.
You needn't go in if you don't want to.
I'll have a go, sir.
Quite sure?
Sir.
The young man slides a gas mask over his face. Behind him, other soldiers hold a long rope tied around his upper torso. A guard stops a black sedan. Behind him, men watch the soldier walk across a white line painted on the road.
Captain there.
An older man wearing a bow tie gets out of the car and waves the guard aside. Glancing at the field, he spots a cow lying on its side, then finds Alan standing near a truck marked Civil Defense Corps.
Alan, what on earth happened
here? Just a minute. Oh, hello, Doctor. Glad you're here. We may need you.
They watch the soldier slowly walk ahead. He bends to look at Gobby, then suddenly keels over in the road. The other soldiers quickly pull the lifeless man back across the white line.
What's wrong with him?
That's what we're trying to find out. Will you take a look at him, Doc?
I'll take off the respirator.
The doctor crouches beside the soldier and feels his wrist.
Pulse is normal. Seems to be breathing normally.
He opens the soldier's eye.
I think he's just fainted.
The young man moves his head.
He's coming around. Alan, you better let me know what this is all about.
Doctor, when were you last in the village?
Midwich? Oh, I left about 10 o'clock. Had a couple of patients to see in Widmarsh. Now there are roadblocks all over the place. Alan, I've got to get back. I've got patients to see.
Well, my hunch is that all your patients in Midwich are in the same state as this man.
The soldier winces.
All right, old chap. Take it easy. Take it easy.
What can it be? To put a man out like a light, penetrate our respirators, do all this.
Some sort of gas?
No, it can't be. Any breeze would have blown it about a bit. The edges of the area are as well defined as that hedge there.
Cold.
What did you say?
Ice cold.
Soldiers help the young man stand.
I'm all right, sir. Only cold. My hands are like ice.
The men look up as a plane flies high overhead. Alan walks over to the radio operator.
Midwich to Charlie Alpha. Midwich to Charlie Alpha. Can you see anything? Over.
Everything looks all right from here. Over.
Let me speak to him. Hello, Charlie Alpha. This is Major Burnett speaking. Can you see nothing unusual at all in Midwich? Nothing moving?
No, sir, nothing. Matter of fact, that's odd. Nothing is moving down there. I can see some people, but they're not moving either. They're lying on the ground.
As though they've fallen?
Yes, sir.
Right. Take it down slowly, but pull up the minute you feel anything.
Feel anything, sir?
Anything unusual?
Roger.
The plane dips slightly, flying over two large manors surrounded by woods and fields.
Still nothing moving, sir. Taking it down.
Careful now.
As the plane descends, the pilot's eyelids begin to droop and his mouth goes slack. Alan watches the plane from below.
Easy.
The pilot struggles to keep his head up, then collapses against the controls.
Easy.
The plane goes into a steep dive. At the checkpoint, the men watch as the plane plummets toward a stand of trees. A fireball shoots up from the woods. Alan watches a large cloud of black smoke rise from the wreckage, then squeezes his eyes shut and lowers his head. Dr. Willers gazes ahead, his mouth slack. The men stand frozen as they watch the black cloud dissipate in the sky. In the distance, Alan spots another plane.
There's another aircraft approaching. Send out a general warning immediately. All aircraft to avoid this area and not to drop below 5,000 feet.
Yes, sir. Midwich to base, Midwich to base. Emergency. I say again, emergency. Warn all aircraft to avoid area 5 miles radius. Latitude, 51 degrees, 10 minutes, 30 seconds north. Longitude, 1 degree, 11 minutes, 20 seconds west. Maintain minimum altitude of 5,000 feet. Out.
The plane veers off to the left. In the field, the cow lying on its side begins to stir. Dr. Willers stares at it, his brow furrowing. A soldier looks down the road.
Blimey, look!
A man gets off the wrecked bus. Holding the door open, he helps a woman make her way down the steps. In the field, the cow stands up. One by one, the passengers file out of the bus. Alan and Dr. Willers exchange a puzzled look. Alan slowly walks to the white line painted on the road. He hesitates, then steps across. Alan walks over to Gobby, lying in the road. The constable sits up beside his bicycle and scratches his head. In the general store, the operator removes her headset and runs her hand over her hair. She hurries to help the white-haired woman gather the groceries scattered on the floor. Standing, they exchange a weary look, then glance at the overflowing sink in the back room. The operator stumbles to the faucet and turns off the water. Now, in the small dining room, the teenager douses the smoldering dress on the ironing board, then sets the iron aside. The middle-aged woman staggers toward a mirror and examines a cut over her eye. Rushing to her, the teenage girl dabs the cut with a cloth napkin. In the manor house's library, the dog lifts its head. Gordon hangs up the phone. Leaning back in his chair, Gordon yawns and rubs his face. An attractive middle-aged woman with short dark hair walks in.
Gordon? Darling, I'm sorry. I must have dozed off. Look at the time. It's almost 3 o'clock. Why didn't you call me?
Gordon cocks his head.
I'd better go and see about lunch.
Anthea?
She turns, her plaid dress hugging her slim figure. Gordon stands and scratches his head.
I find myself asleep on the floor. What an extraordinary thing to do.
Anthea shivers and rubs her arms.
Ooh. I'm cold.
Gordon points to the unlit fireplace and pats the dog.
Did we faint?
You must have blacked out.
Why?
He tries to strike a match.
My hands are quite numb.
Anthea rubs his hand.
Gordon, what did happen?
I don't know.
Outside, Alan pulls up the driveway in his two-door sedan with chrome trim. He parks by the columned entrance of the manor and gets out of the car. Wearing a thick overcoat, he runs inside to the library. Anthea turns and smiles.
Alan!
You're all right.
You're late.
I couldn't get through.
Couldn't get through?
Alan, what did you mean, you're all right? I mean, how did you know?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, but we seem to have blacked out for several hours.
I know,
it
you
must
see,
have been some sort of slow leak in the gas.
It wasn't only you two. The whole village fell asleep.
Village.
All of Midwich was cut off from the outside world for several hours.
In town, a military truck and a police car drive past the village green. Soldiers jump from the back of a parked truck. Two motorcycle officers escort more trucks past stone houses. Villagers watch from the side of the road. At a checkpoint by the green, soldiers wearing headphones sweep metal detectors over the ground. Another soldier runs a Geiger counter over a man's back. Policemen hold back a group of onlookers. Alan and Gordon walk up to a soldier scanning a baby carriage with a handheld counter.
Anything registering, sir?
No, sir, nothing unusual.
Well, keep at it.
The operator rushes out of the general store.
Oh, Mr. Sellerby?
Yes, Miss Ogle.
Are these people from the telephone company?
Not the telephone company, no.
That's what I said. I mean, if they want to pull the wool over our eyes, they ought to try something better.
Yes, well, I'm trying to find out...
After all, we're not stupid, are we? What's happened isn't natural.
Tell you what we'll do. I'll press for an official explanation while you help to stop the rumors getting about, all right?
She smiles and walks back to the store. A soldier approaches her with a Geiger counter.
Do you mind?
Soil samples?
Yes, sir.
Plant life?
Even the bark on the trees, but I don't think...
Don't forget insects, grasses, water, metals. The sooner and more elaborate these tests can be made, the better.
Yes, sir.
It's quite all right. This is Professor Gordon Zellerbeck.
Oh, yes, sir.
Dr. Willers steps out of a row house.
Well, no one seems to have come to any harm. A few cuts and bruises where they fell. Lucky no one was in their bath. They might have been drowned.
Yes. Hello, Mrs. Harrington.
Well, I think the least they can do is offer us some kind of compensation.
But you feel all right?
No thanks to them if I do. And a large burn in my best dress into the bargain.
What the wife means is... Well, you don't hardly expect to drop asleep before dinner, do you?
In the general's office.
We've established that whatever it was static, odorless, invisible. It didn't register on radar, it was non-metallic, it showed nothing on our Geiger counters. You've got the reports there, Gordon. There are no signs of any physical, biological, or psychological changes.
Well, that's practically meaningless. For instance... Serious exposure to X-rays or gamma rays need not have an immediate effect. But these people have to be kept under observation.
And yourself?
And my household.
It would be a bit tricky to put you all in the sanatorium.
In any case, my instructions are to keep this whole incident out of the limelight.
National security, eh?
If you like.
Well, until we know the cause, we shan't know what to expect.
Since you're there, Gordon, suppose you keep an eye on Midwich for us. If you do find anything, let us know through Alan. No need for any direct contact between us.
More security, eh? Ever cautious.
Gets under the skin, you know.
Now in the library, Gordon plays the piano. His white German shepherd lies at his feet. As he plays, he looks up from the keys and gazes outside through a pair of open French doors. Gordon walks through the doors to a veranda covered with potted plants and small trees. He picks up a short, blooming plant and examines it closely. Now at the general store, the white-haired woman sets four jars on the counter.
Anything else today, Mrs. Ellaby?
No, that's all, thank you. I'll have to get in a new supply of these pickles if you go on like this.
Yes, I do seem to be getting through a lot these days, don't I? That'll be 17 and 6. Shall I add it to the account?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, how's the professor?
Oh, he's very well. Very well indeed. Good morning.
Good morning.
Anthea leaves. Smiling, the shopkeeper walks over to the switchboard operator.
Miss Ogle, dear.
Yes?
I think there's going to be news up at Kyle Manor.
News? What kind of news?
Later at home, Anthea walks onto the veranda.
Hello.
Gordon sits with his back to the door.
I said hello.
Oh. How long have you been here?
Ages.
Liar.
Gordon pecks her on the lips. He starts to leave, but Anthea pulls him back with a passionate embrace.
I've just discovered a fascinating thing. Here are the plant samples we took that day. Now, this one, for example, a perfectly ordinary Pelargonium zonale. And you see what's happening? Exactly what you'd expect if I made a 50% grant. Why did you kiss me like that? Come on. What's the secret? Something's afoot. Why are you so happy?
Now, Gordon, I want you to sit down. Keep quite calm. There's nothing to worry about. Now, we have apparently succeeded in crossing a Zelepi gordonius with a Zelepi anthium. Just what the results will be, we shan't know for some time yet.
Gordon jumps up from his chair.
I think you should sit down. Can I get you some tea?
No.
A drink. Well, that wouldn't be right. Feet up. Something to eat?
Yes, please.
What?
Cheese, pickles, and half a dozen anchovies. Recently my favorite diet. Hadn't you noticed? Mrs. Plumpton at the shop has.
I've been too engrossed in my work. But we'll change all that.
Gordon kneels beside Anthea. She cradles his face in her hands as they exchange a long, tender kiss.
Thank you, darling. You've made my happiness complete. But all the more so because I'm old enough to appreciate it. Now then, what was it you wanted? Cheese, pickles, and half a dozen anchovies.
Gordon holds his stomach and winces. Now in Dr. Willer's office, a young woman sits beside his desk. She looks up at the doctor with tear-filled eyes.
I'm afraid there's no doubt about it.
Millie, I wish there was something I could say to comfort you, because I know the sort of thing you'll have to put up with from some of the people in the village over this. But you can count on me to do anything I can to help you and your child.
But do you think that I've... Do you think that I could...
Millie, I've told you there's no doubt about it. Now, if there's anyone you want me to talk to about this...
But I've never... It's impossible. It's impossible.
Now in a dining room.
This is some present, Jim. Thanks a lot. Where'd you say you got it? Tokyo?
Jim scowls.
Oh, it's a real beauty. You can take action pictures in this light.
Jan, look at me. When I learn to use this properly, I might go into the photo business.
Jan, turn this way. That's right. I want to see how... What's the matter with you? Jim comes back after a whole year away and you look as if you were going to a funeral.
Jan looks into Jim's glaring eyes, her lips quivering. He storms out. Jan runs upstairs, now in an office.
An attempted suicide.
Janet Paul, whose husband only came back from sea yesterday.
It's dreadful, dreadful.
Three other women in the village half out of their minds. Millie Hughes, Rose Shepherd, and Mary Burnett.
Please don't go.
That's why we are asking you to tell us, Vicar.
Please don't keep on. Don't you see that what you're asking me, it's not right ethically.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Vicar. How do you think I feel? I married late in life. When my wife told me that she was going to have a baby, it was the happiest moment I've ever known. Don't talk to me about ethics.
Don't you see that this is something which concerns all of us? That this is the one moment when it is your duty to break confidence?
Very well. Four of them have been to see me. One of them is only 17.
Evelyn Harrington?
Yes. She was terribly frightened, and frankly, so am I. I know these girls. I've watched them grow up. And when they tell me that they have no way of accounting for their condition, well, I'm compelled to believe them.
That means that every woman in this village who is capable of childbirth is going to have a baby.
I can't believe it.
This is not a matter of belief, Vicar. It's a matter of fact. And there's something else. All this seems to date from that day 2 months ago when Midwich was cut off from the rest of the world.
Now in town, a large van marked Mobile X-ray Unit sits parked by a road. A pregnant woman exits as another one enters. Mrs. Harrington walks toward the van with her husband and teenage daughter Evelyn. Mr. Harrington puts his arm around Evelyn as a nurse steps out of the van.
Who's next?
Evelyn waddles up the steps to the van, followed by her mother, their stomachs bulging under their overcoats. Harrington gives his wife a faint smile, then leaves, his head bowed. Now, in the library, Anthea sits in a wingback chair by the fireplace. Gordon walks over and caresses her cheek. Her worried face softens at his touch. Gordon walks into the next room, and Anthea's smile fades. Now, in a waiting room full of pregnant women, a man in a white lab coat carries an X-ray. He enters Dr. Willer's office, where Gordon stands by the window.
This is Anthea Zellabis, Doctor.
Gordon's eyes dart to Dr. Willer's, smoking a cigarette.
Let's have a look at it.
The man hangs the X-ray on a glass view box. Dr. Willer's flips on the light and examines the image. With a worried look, Gordon joins them.
It's one of the most perfectly formed embryos I've ever seen.
Yes, but is it normal?
It's more than normal. It's a 7-month embryo after only 5 months.
Now at the Zellabys, Anthea lies in bed, staring blankly ahead. Gordon enters, smiling.
It's all right, darling. I've seen the X-rays, and it's a fine specimen. Dr. Willis says it's perfect, absolutely normal.
That should make us very happy.
Well, it's going to be all right.
Is it? Is that what you believe?
You're tired, darling.
That's right. I'm tired. And do you know why? Because every night I lie awake and worry.
Well, now you don't have to worry anymore.
You don't really believe that, do you?
Dr. Willis...
I don't care what Dr. Willis says. Oh, right, so it's not a monster. It's a perfect specimen. But what does that tell me?
You're going to have a baby.
Whose baby? Yours? Does it tell me what kind of life is going inside me? What sort of brain it has? Where it comes from? Does it tell me that? Where does it
stop
come
it.
From?
You must stop it. We've got to be rational about this. We may not be any better off than any of the others, but there's absolutely nothing we can do but wait.
Gordon.
Maybe it's ours, maybe it isn't. If it's ours, we shall know. If it isn't...
Gordon.
He turns to her.
I'm afraid.
Anthea buries her face in Gordon's chest.
I'm so afraid.
Nighttime. A black sedan drives up to a 2-story brick townhouse. Jan Paul steps out of the car. Inside, her husband Jim peers out of a window as she walks up to the house. Balancing a cigarette in his mouth, he opens the front door for her. Jan goes upstairs without looking at him, her belly round under her thick overcoat. Jim lingers at the bottom of the staircase, then walks over to the dining room table and clenches his fist over its corner. He settles into a chair and takes a drag on his cigarette, then downs a shot of liquor. Now, in the small dining room, a record spins on the Victrola. Mr. Harrington grabs the needle off the record, then slams the lid shut. He reaches into a closet and pulls out a scarf, then opens the front door. Wrapping the scarf around his neck, Harrington passes through a wooden gate in front of the townhouse. He buttons his sport jacket as he ambles toward a white building across the village green. Now in a pub, a bartender dries a beer mug. Men sit around the bar, their eyes distant. The bartender glances up as Harrington enters, then dries another mug. Harrington sluggishly walks past a man playing darts. At the bar, Harrington sits, stroking his thick mustache as the bartender pours him a pint of beer. He takes a long drink from the glass, then wrinkles his forehead.
I hope that none of them lives.
Now at the Zellabys, Gordon paces. Alan sits nearby.
What a ridiculous way to behave.
A nurse steps out of a room.
You've been terribly busy, Mr. Zellaby, but doctors had to tell you that Mrs. Zellaby's fine.
And the baby?
Perfect.
In every respect?
No, Gordon. You got a cigarette?
How about the baby?
Oh, splendid. Unusually heavy, though. 10 pounds, 8 ounces. Strange eyes. Oh, all right, I'm going now. Got a cigarette?
Yes, of course.
The dog follows Gordon into the room.
How many others have been delivered so far tonight?
Ralphie is my third.
What about their weight?
All slightly over 10 pounds. They've all got these strange eyes.
In the room, Anthea lies in bed. Gordon holds her hand.
All that worry. And now... Oh, Gordon, have you seen him? He's such a beautiful baby.
Across the room, the German Shepherd lies on a rug, eyeing the baby's crib. Anthea gently pulls Gordon to her and gives him a lingering kiss.
Gordon, I do love you so.
The dog bares his fangs at the crib.
He's probably jealous. Now be quiet, Bruno. Lie down and behave yourself.
Bruno cowers over to a corner and lies down. Gordon leans over the crib, gazing down intently. The nurse approaches.
Handsome, isn't he?
Gordon gives the baby a sideways glance. Now in the library.
Take a look at this, doctor. It's a section of hair.
Willers looks into a microscope and adjusts the focus.
Yes, it's flat on one side. On the other, an arc, somewhat in the shape of a narrow capital D.
It belongs to my son, David. Have you ever seen such a hair type before? Have you noticed their nails?
Yes, they're narrower than ours, covering less of the upper surface of the digit, but as flat as normal nails.
What did the blood test show?
Oh, it's too early to tell. The blood circulating at present is still that of the mother's group.
So they are apparently normal children with these exceptions. Strange eyes, arresting, I would say, an unknown hair group, and unusual fingernails.
Whatever they are, their physical development is absolutely startling. In point of time, they're 4 months old, but their development and capabilities is that of 18 months.
Upstairs, the nurse struggles with Anthea.
Oh, please, Selby, you must... Oh, no, please!
Anthea plunges her arm into a pot of hot water. Gordon enters.
She won't stop, sir. She won't stop.
Anthea flails wildly. Gordon slaps her. Across the room, a baby with light blonde hair sits in a crib, staring at Anthea. Gordon helps his wife to a chair. Dr. Willers examines her arm.
What happened?
I was giving David his bottle. I must have forgotten to test it. It was too hot for him. He spat it out.
He just seemed to glare at her.
Get my bag from the car.
Is that any reason to scald yourself?
Anthea glances toward the crib. The baby returns her look with unblinking eyes. Now, in a child's room, Gordon watches a blonde-haired toddler play with letter blocks. Wearing a jumper, the little boy arranges them to spell a name. David. Gordon looks at the name and tilts his head. The pale toddler gives him an icy stare. Later, in the same room, Gordon shows Alan a small wooden box.
This box is a product of Oriental ingenuity. There are no visible means of opening it. But if you do just what I've shown you, it comes open. I'll see if you can do it.
Alan examines the ornate box, turning it over in his hands. Sitting in a playpen, the little boy watches him. Alan pushes a small wooden slat on the end of the box.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that comes down.
He tries to slide open the top, but it doesn't budge. Alan slowly pushes down a panel on the end, then slides open the top. He slides up the other end and pulls out a tiny drawer hidden inside.
Splendid. Well, you see, it shows that I was right to marry your sister. Your family has brains.
Gordon puts the box back together.
I can do this myself. Very well. But now watch this. And remember that he's only 1 year old.
Gordon gives the box to the little boy.
Go on, open it, David.
David pushes the slat on the end.
Yes. There's something inside. It's a chocolate.
His small hands quickly slide open the top of the puzzle box. Alan's eyes whiten as the boy opens the hidden drawer and eats the chocolate inside. Anthea enters and picks up David from his playpen.
Come along, it's time for your bath.
Oh. This is fantastic. You think so? Come with me.
At the Harringtons.
It's all right, Evie. It's only a box with a chocolate in it.
I don't know, sir. I never lie to have chocolates.
It's quite harmless, really. I just gave some to David.
Gordon gives the box to Evelyn's daughter. Sitting on the floor, the blonde toddler begins opening it. Mrs. Harrington stands at the bottom of a staircase holding a little blonde boy. An older, dark-haired boy stands beside them. They watch as Evelyn's daughter slides open the panels on the box. Gordon smiles as the little girl takes the chocolate out of the secret drawer.
But you didn't even show her how to do it.
Well, that's exactly my point. I didn't have to. If you demonstrate something to one of them, they all know it. Now watch.
Gordon hands the box to Mrs. Harrington's son. He starts to open it, but the older dark-haired boy snatches it away.
I want that. Keith, give it back to him at once.
The irises of the little boy's eyes glow around his black pupils. Keith stops working on the box and stares transfixed at the toddler. Keith heads for the other room, but the little girl's eyes start glowing. He freezes in place as she stares up at him, her blonde hair clipped back from her pale, plump cheeks. Mrs. Harrington gazes nervously at the toddler in her arms. Gordon and Alan exchange a puzzled look. Keith turns and walks mechanically to the little boy, then hands him the box. The toddler begins sliding open the different sections. Mrs. Harrington watches her son with a bewildered look. Alan observes intently. The boy takes the chocolate from the drawer and pops it into his mouth. The two blonde toddlers gaze at each other without blinking, their faces somber. Later, on a dirt road by the general store, village kids play with a soccer ball. Five blonde children in identical dark overcoats walk nearby. The three girls have straight shoulder-length hair, and the two boys bowl haircuts. A village kid throws the ball at the children. It hits one of the girls in the back of the head. The blonde children whip around in unison. The girl transfixes the village kids with a penetrating stare.
No, Nancy. Leave them alone.
David leads the other children away. A woman stands at the front gate of a nearby yard.
Ted Brewer, you come inside this moment. I've told you about playing with those children before.
Now in the general store, David speaks with Miss Ogle.
There's my Philip. You're always all together.
It's his turn to study. Is it your home?
It's his home, too.
You're anxious for us to leave, aren't you?
You have the same every week. 12 jars, 15 shillings.
David hands Mrs. Plumpton some money. She gives him the change.
You wish we wouldn't come here anymore, Mrs. Plumpton?
I never said.
It's what you're thinking. You've nothing to fear from us. However, in future, someone else will come for our order. Goodbye, Mrs. Plumpton. Good afternoon, Miss Ogle.
The children leave with their box of groceries. Mrs. Plumpton looks at Miss Ogle and shakes her head. Miss Ogle bites her lip and lowers her eyes. Now in the Zellabys' dining room, Gordon sips a cup of coffee and looks out the window. Alan enters, wearing his officer's uniform. Gordon continues staring outside.
Are you ready, Gordon?
He turns from the window.
Some coffee?
No, thanks. Gordon, don't you think Anthea should know about this conference? What's being discussed?
There's no reason to alarm her just because you're alarmed.
Alan and Gordon walk into the foyer.
I haven't got your cold scientific detachment. People, especially children, aren't measured by their IQ. What's important about them is whether they're good or bad. And these children are bad to everyone but you.
But they are children, Alan. And children are not born with a sense of moral values. They have to be taught. With their intellect, that should be simple.
Intellect? Intellect? That's all you care about. What if you can't teach them? What if you can't put the brake of morals on them?
First, we must try.
You're blinded by this vision of intellect. You see David as another Einstein.
Potentially greater.
Solving the riddle of the universe. Your son, David.
Anthea's son. I have no proof that he's mine.
As Alan and Gordon leave, a maid carries a silver tray past a staircase. At the top of the stairs, Anthea gazes down at the foyer. She turns and walks down a hallway, then enters a room. Inside, David buttons his tweed suit jacket. Anthea watches, then gently closes the door behind her.
Where's Father gone?
To London. You must hurry, David.
Why?
She helps him with his tie, but he turns aside.
You'll be late.
No, I meant, why has he gone to London?
He has some business there.
What sort of business?
A conference.
He takes a stack of books from Anthea.
Don't you like me to help you, David?
Thank you, but I'm old enough to do things for myself. Father agrees with that.
Buckling a strap around the books, he cuts himself.
Darling, your finger.
She rushes to him.
Let me do that.
It doesn't hurt. Please don't fuss.
It might turn septic. There.
She bandages his cut, then gives him a kiss.
You said I must hurry. Goodbye, Mother.
Anthea frowns.
Goodbye, David.
Now in a conference room.
Gentlemen, as the Home Secretary has permitted this disclosure, I can now inform you that Midwich is not the only colony of such children. Here, at a township in northern Australia, 30 infants were born in one day. But apparently something went wrong. All the children died within 10 hours of birth.
The general points to a large map.
In an Eskimo community, there were 10 births. The community didn't take kindly to this. Golden-haired babies born of black-haired mothers violated the taboos. None survived. In the communist world, there were two timeouts similar to the one at Midwich. One at Irkutsk, here, on the borders of Outer Mongolia. A grim affair. The men killed the children and their mothers. Second, in the mountains of the northwest, all the children survived. Our reports, though limited, indicate that they're receiving education on the highest level. All these timeouts happened on the same day as the one at Midwich.
This is now 3 years ago. Have we established anything about the origins of these children?
There's very little to go on.
Zellaby, you must have some theory.
Yes, I suggest that Zellaby may be somewhat too intimately involved.
My position as a dubious father is influencing my scientific detachment. Is that what you think?
I have reason to believe so.
Well, let's hear what the others have to say.
Dr. Carlyle?
I went into the question of mutation. Once in a great many thousand years, an abrupt jump may take place in animal or in vegetable life. A new variation suddenly occurs for no apparent reason.
Would that explain why entire groups of people were cut off for periods of several hours?
No, sir. It would not.
Very well. Any other line of thought?
Yes. There is the possibility of the transmission of energy. May I put it this way? Already, we can direct radar beams out into space with the utmost accuracy. Electrical impulses have been bounced off the moon, and we are continually receiving impulses from other planets and stars. And impulses are energy and matter.
We're aware of that, Professor Smith. Where does it take us?
The professor and I think alike. What we can do, others elsewhere in the universe may be able to do better.
Exactly.
Let me get this straight. You imply that these children may be the result of impulses directed towards us from somewhere in the universe.
Well, of course, that's just a theory, but there's nothing to disprove it. They may be a case of mutation. They may be the world's new people. What we need is time to investigate. Time!
Just a moment, Zellaby. General Layton, you tell me of some developments at Midwich. What are they?
A series of casualties, mostly among the village children. In each case, after some contact with the others.
Children get into fights all over the world.
These were not fights in the normal sense. No direct physical violence was involved. But 2 weeks ago, a boy, a good swimmer, was drowned in the Midwich Pond for no logical reason.
Children also have accidents.
Gordon, you've seen it for yourself. The extraordinary power these children have and the sinister way they use it.
Extraordinary power, certainly. Yes, that's precisely why we need time.
In our view, it's only a matter of time before these children get entirely out of hand with fatal consequences.
What do you suggest?
That they be shut away.
You mean put in prison?
Bluntly, yes.
You might as well do away with them altogether.
This isn't a police state. Yet.
But don't you see what you're doing? If you imprison them, you will deprive the scientific world of the greatest opportunity it has ever had.
Opportunity for what?
For study. Gentlemen, a great deal has been said here about the power of these children, but nothing about the nature of this power. What we are dealing with is a mass mind. An entirely new development, like a colony of ants and bees. These children all want to dress alike, and what one learns, they all learn. I demonstrated this to Alan Bernard. They are one mind to the 12th power. Now,
just think what it would mean if we could guide it. We could leap forward in science 100 years.
At the risk of being destroyed.
What cannot be understood must be put away. Is that your view, the age-old fear of the unknown?
On the other hand, Zellaby, Layton has a point. There is a potential danger here.
We are gathered here as advisors, as scientists, as government experts. Now, take a look at our world. Have we made a good job of it? Who's to say that these children are not the answer?
The answer to what?
Well, to wars, to disease, to human want and misery, to all of the problems we've been unable to cope with.
If they don't make an end of us in the meantime.
We cannot throw away this potential just because of a few incidents.
What is your suggestion?
I'll compromise with Layton. Let them live together under one roof in our village where they can be kept under observation.
My department couldn't accept the responsibility.
I personally will assume full responsibility. Just give me a year.
Mr. Home Secretary, I can't agree to this.
But all I ask is a year. Now, surely that's not too much time when so much is at stake. Just give me 1 year.
Very well. I will officially recommend your compromise. Thank you, gentlemen.
Gordon sighs. Alan flashes him a hard look. Now in a classroom, physics problems cover a blackboard.
Well, that's as far as we shall go today.
Our next lecture will deal with structure. And by the way, don't forget you'll be living here from tomorrow. Now.
At their seats, the blonde children grin at each other.
Why do you smile? David?
You don't know how to put your question.
There isn't much point in my trying to be subtle, is there? The question I was going to put was... By the way... Just how deep do you see into my mind?
Everything that's in the front of your mind.
The thought processes? The reasoning that leads to my spoken words?
We still have to master that. It'll come.
Well, that's frank. Thank you, David. At least I still have some privacy. Now, the question I want to ask is this. Are you aware of life on another planet?
The children close their eyes and bow their heads.
And let me put it this way. It is possible that life exists elsewhere, isn't it?
David looks up at his father.
Well, we don't seem to be getting anywhere. Why are you so nervous when an aircraft flies above you?
You're very observant, Father.
Yes, but that doesn't answer my question.
All right. Until recently, we haven't been able to make our control reach as far as a high aircraft.
Well, now you have, is that it?
David nods.
What are you going to do with that power?
Father, we know what you're trying to find out. It'd be better if you didn't ask these questions. We want to learn from you.
All right, that'll be all for today.
As the children leave, Gordon lingers at his desk. He sighs.
David?
Yes, Father?
Carrying a briefcase, Gordon walks up to his son.
I'll walk home with you.
Later, in David's room, Anthea packs.
What I meant was that you don't have to go, David, if you don't want to.
I'd rather go.
You mean that because the others are moving into the school, you feel that you must too? Is that the logic?
Yes.
Your mother is quite distressed about it.
I don't really know why I should be. Lots of parents send their children away to school, and David will only be half a mile away.
I suppose there's nothing that'll make you change your mind.
No.
Anthea closes the suitcase.
I think that's all.
Kneeling, she puts her arms around David.
Thank you.
He looks at her blankly. Anthea's smile fades as David takes the suitcase and walks out. Later, Anthea and David walk down a street. Anthea waves to a passing motorist. Ahead, a blonde girl steps in front of the car without looking. The car brakes, bumping the girl backwards.
I'm very sorry. It was all my fault.
The driver gets out.
You all right?
David joins the girl and two other blonde boys. They slowly back away from the man. The stone-faced children stare at him, and their eyes begin to glow. A vacant look falls over the man's face. Turning stiffly, he gets into his car. The driver's eyes fix on the distance, and he accelerates straight toward a brick wall. Clenching her eyes shut, Anthea turns her head. She looks back to see smoke billowing from the crumpled car and flames rising from the engine. The children stare at the wreck. Then David turns to his mother and fixes her with an unblinking gaze. A smile flickers across his lips. Now, in a crowded room of townspeople, Anthea stands before a man at a desk.
Mrs. Zellerby, I wish you'd be more specific in your testimony. I know these things are difficult, but it's our obligation to determine the responsibility for this man's death.
I find it very difficult to remember.
The blonde children sit nearby.
You told Constable Gobby you heard the screech of his brakes.
Yes, that's right. He got out of the car.
The children stare at Anthea.
Then what did he do, Mrs. Zellerby?
Then he got back into the car and drove straight for the wall.
Thank you, Mrs. Zellerby. I don't think we need go any further. It seems to me quite apparent what happened here. Edward Paul, the deceased, his vision obscured, came close to striking and injuring a child. Then, obviously in nervous shock, struck the wall.
I recommend that you bring in a verdict of accidental death.
Mrs. Ellaby, you know they killed him.
Jim Paul stands.
Ask them! Just ask them!
He glances at the children.
Who is that man?
James Paul, sir, brother of the deceased.
I shall overlook this outburst.
Jim storms out. Later, Alan, Anthea, and Gordon walk down a dirt road.
Gordon, can't you see now that Midwich is living on top of a volcano? A force is building up. Sooner or later, it's bound to explode.
We still haven't any proof.
For heaven's sake, how much more proof do you need? The death of James Paul?
Alan, I'm much more aware of the situation than you think.
Nearby, Jim aims a shotgun at a group of blonde children walking in the distance. Gordon races over and pushes down the barrel.
Jim! Why not? Look what they did to my brother.
This won't bring it back.
Who's going to stop them if I don't try?
You can't stop them with that, believe me.
They're not human. They ought to be destroyed.
Go home, Jim. I said go home. Leave here now before they get any closer.
Jim eyes the four children, then lowers his head.
All right, Mr. Sillaby.
As he leaves, the children approach, their hands in the pockets of their short, dark coats. They suddenly stop, and their heads snap toward Jim. Gathering tightly behind David, the children fix their gaze on Jim as he walks away. Jim stops, then slowly turns. His heavy-eyed gaze drifts into the distance. Anthea and Gordon look from Jim to the grim-faced children. A boy gives the adults a steely look, freezing them in place. In unison, the adults turn stiffly, their eyes vacant. The boy returns his gaze to Jim, standing fixed in place. The children's eyes glow. Jim stands locked in their gaze, his jaw slack. He slowly lifts the shotgun under his arm. The other adults watch, sleepy-eyed and motionless. Jim guides the end of the barrel under his chin, his face beaded with sweat. His fingers inch their way along the stock to the trigger of the gun. The young boy turns back toward the adults. Blinking, the vacant look disappears from their faces. Their eyes dart in Jim's direction, and Thea's mouth drops. Gordon and Alan grimace. The children casually put their hands back in their coat pockets, then stride away, single file, through a clearing in the woods. Anthea shuts her eyes and rocks her head back. She bites her gloved hand, stifling a cry. Now in the Zellaby's library.
Oh, all right, all right. I'm responsible. I never denied it. It's quite possible that but for me, these two men would still be alive. I was over-optimistic.
There's quite a shindig in London. They may be after your blood, Gordon.
You think I care a rap about that? What beats me is that I have failed to reach the children.
But the point is, they're shouting for action. Now, things have gone too far. The village is very near panicky.
If only I could get inside the children's minds and read their thoughts, as quite obviously they can read ours.
Yes.
Doesn't that assume they have thoughts?
Yes, he is. Just
and minds, as we understand them?
Alan, it's for you, General Layton.
Excuse me.
Alan takes the receiver.
Yes, sir?
His face grows somber.
I see, yes, sir.
Gordon paces.
It's as though their minds were surrounded by a brick wall. If only I could break through it.
Yes, sir, certainly. Have I your permission to pass this on? Right, thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Alan hangs up. Anthea hands him a cup of coffee as he rejoins the others.
I'm afraid there have been grave developments. The Russian army group in the Western Urals is equipped with a new type of gun. It can project a shell up to 60 miles, an atomic shell. And apparently they tried it out yesterday on the village of Raminsk, where their children live. And the village of Raminsk no longer exists.
You mean everyone there?
The entire place. They gave no warning. They couldn't evacuate the villagers without the children learning what was to happen. They developed more quickly than ours. They've begun to take control. An attempt to move them with soldiers proved disastrous to the troops and the adults.
I see. So now I suppose we're going to blow Midwich off the face of the earth.
No, but in view of recent events, they feel your compromise has failed. Leighton feels you ought to move immediately before it's too late.
Destroy them.
Well, they're meeting tonight to come to a decision. They want me in town.
Alan sets his coffee cup on a table and leaves. Gordon stares intently at the brick wall by the fireplace. Now in the classroom, David studies a map of the Soviet Union. In the pub, Harrington slams his mug of beer on the bar.
What I say is, it's got to stop.
Yeah.
First aid, then Jim Paul.
Yeah.
The authorities don't do nothing. Are we going to wait until we all get wiped out? Those that are with me, follow me!
The men charge out of the pub. They gather briefly outside. Then Harrington leads the dozen men down an unpaved street past a block of row houses. Mrs. Harrington and her daughter Evelyn peek out of their window at the passing mob. Wearing an overcoat and a scarf, Harrington strides briskly, men flanking him on either side. Now, walking along a moonlit path past woods, the men spot a lighted schoolhouse across an empty field. They gather sticks and small branches on the ground. In the school, a blond boy looks out the window as the other children study. In the field, Harrington waves the men forward with a torch made of burning sticks. The group follows him, carrying armfuls of branches and straw. In the school, the boy at the window turns to his classmates, who all look up from their desks. David, wearing a jacket with short pants and knee socks, walks to the door. He pauses under the arch of the doorway, then takes a step outside. With torches lighting their way, the villagers trample over the dry grass in the field. They spot David's small, dark figure in the entrance, then freeze. The men step back from Harrington, who stands transfixed. David stares at him with glowing eyes. Harrington's wide, fearful eyes turn dull, and his torch tumbles to the ground. His long overcoat flaps over the torch's flame. The men behind him shake as they try to move, but stay frozen in place. As flames rise around him, Harrington clutches his chest, writhing in pain. On a road near the school, Alan drives by. He notices the fire, then pulls over. In the field, the men watch as the flames engulf Harrington. With a satisfied grin, David goes inside and shuts the door. The men rush to extinguish the flames. Alan climbs over a wooden fence and races toward the crowd. He steps through the crowd of men, then gazes grimly down at Harrington. Alan turns to the schoolhouse. He marches to the front door, his tall frame casting a long shadow over the building's brick wall. Inside, he walks toward David. The children stand at their table, staring up at him.
David, come here.
David doesn't move.
I want to speak to you.
With a slight smirk, David takes a few steps forward. The children gather around Alan.
A man is dead.
We must protect ourselves.
The law exists for your protection.
It's of no use to us.
Of no use to you, is it? And if you think you're going to be allowed to live by your own laws, laws we don't subscribe to...
You're thinking of what happened to the others in another country.
Yes, if you know about that, you should know what to expect.
It'll not happen to us.
You little...
It'll not happen to us because we have to survive, no matter what the cost.
Alan turns to leave, but the children surround him.
I don't think you'll go to London. We are now the only ones left, and you must learn that we're determined to survive, and that there's nothing you can do to stop us.
You have to be taught to leave us alone.
Alan looks blankly ahead.
Leave us alone.
Alan stands immobilized by David's glowing stare. With sweat dripping down his forehead, Alan's eyes begin to glow. Now at the Zellabys, Alan lies in bed, and Thea sits at his side.
He's out of danger now. Go to the library. I'll join you there.
Dr. Willers folds up a stethoscope.
I've never seen as severe a case of shock as this. It's medically impossible. For a while, he was totally paralyzed. Now his pupils are returning to normal. His pulse is less rapid. His color's returning. I've never seen anything like this before. It's time London sent in some troops.
I talked to General Layton. Troops are not the answer. Children would only make them shoot one another. Tonight should be enough for all of us, even me.
What is the answer, then?
I don't know. But no more people must be hurt.
Is there no limit to the power of these children?
No more than there is a limit to the mind.
And Thea opens the door to the library. Her mouth drops.
David! What do you want here? I should have thought...
I want to speak to my father.
She turns to go, then hesitates.
David, why do you do these dreadful things? Wherever it is you come from, you're part of us now. Couldn't you learn to live with us and help us live with you?
I want to speak to my father.
Gordon walks in.
The effect seemed to be wearing off.
Major Bernard will be all right. What we did was only to warn him. And all of you.
Leave us, Anthea.
But I...
Please.
As she leaves, Anthea glances over her shoulder at David. Gordon turns to his son.
You're not afraid of us.
No. But I'm sorry, David. I'm sorry I was wrong about you.
If you didn't suffer from emotions, from feelings, you could be as powerful as we are.
Yes.
You'll never reach our minds. I've come to say it's time for us to go.
Go where?
Away from here before they try to destroy us.
What will you do?
Spread out and disperse. Soon we'll have reached the stage when we can form new colonies. In the meantime, we've attracted too much attention. You must help us to leave.
How would you wish me to help you?
You'll arrange a method of getting us away from here without attracting attention. You'll find a number of families spread over the country that'll take us in.
Yes, well, that'll take a bit of organizing. I'll need a few days.
Yes. And be sure no one finds out. Otherwise, more people will be hurt. You'll tell us the arrangements you've made when you come to give us our lesson on Friday.
David...
You won't be able to deceive us. You know that, don't you?
Yes, I know that.
Very well. Let us know your arrangements on Friday.
David walks toward the door, then turns to Gordon.
Good night, Father.
Good night, David.
David leaves. Gordon wanders over to the fireplace and studies the wall.
A brick wall.
Now Anthea supports Alan as they walk down the staircase.
All right now?
The sight's still a bit foggy, but clearing all the time.
I'll just go and tell Gordon.
In the library, Gordon plays the piano. Anthea enters.
Remember this? You wore a dark blue dress. Your hair was longer then. It caught the moonlight.
Anthea flashes a coy smile.
We're ready, Gordon.
Good.
Gordon walks to Anthea and clasps her arms.
I wish you'd...
It's 8:15. You'll be in London by 9:30.
I wish...
wish you'd let me stay here. Or come with us.
No, you know that isn't possible. I have things to do here.
And poor old Alan would go into the nearest tree if you let him drive.
Nothing like feeling useless.
You're still going to see the children tonight?
Yes. Every Wednesday and Friday.
After what happened?
Especially after what happened. I think I've found a way of getting through to them. And if I'm right, we'll have no further trouble.
How?
I'll tell you if I succeed. Now, come on. I don't want you to be on the road all night.
She rests her head against him.
Yeah, no. This isn't like you.
I know it. It's silly of me, but I'm afraid of them. And I'm afraid for you whenever you're with them.
They won't harm me. In a strange way, they trust me. Why, even David seems to accept me. Divorced from my emotions, of course. All right?
Anthea nods.
Off you go. Alan, look after her for me.
I'll give you a ring in the morning.
Yes, in the morning.
Anthea helps Alan into the passenger side of his car. With a faint smile, Gordon watches Anthea climb into the driver's side. He waves to them, then slowly shuts the front door. Gordon walks across the foyer and into the library. He sits at his desk and opens a drawer, then takes out 6 sticks of dynamite wired to a clock. He sets the alarm for 8:30, then lays the round metal clock on the desk. Gordon squints up at the brick wall by the fireplace, then looks back at his desk. As he attaches a wire from the clock to a detonator, he glances at the brick wall again. His brow furrows as he assembles the device. Gordon gently places the explosives into his black leather briefcase and snaps it shut. He stands and pauses by the fireplace, then closes his eyes.
Brick wall. I just think of a brick wall.
By the hearth, the dog sits up and looks at Gordon. Gordon pets him on the head.
I'm sorry, old man. You can't come. Look after your mistress.
The dog watches Gordon walk to the door. Gordon pauses and throws a quick glance around the room, then leaves. The German Shepherd lies in front of the dwindling fire and stares at the door. On the mantle above the hearth, a small wooden clock reads 8:17. Our view glides past small figurines on the mantelpiece to the brick wall. Now, Anthea and Alan drive down a country road.
Alan, what did he mean?
Huh?
Why should he ask you to take care of me?
I don't know. Just a manner of speech, I suppose.
Anthea knits her brow. Now, Gordon pulls up to the schoolhouse. Sitting in his car, he stares somberly at the building. On the country road, Anthea breaks to a stop.
What's the matter?
Alan, I'm going back.
Why?
I'm going back.
She puts the car in reverse. Back at the school, the children watch Gordon enter and put the briefcase down on his desk.
Good evening, children. Tonight we shall talk about atomic energy and how discoveries made about 100 years ago completely changed our conception of the elements and the place of the atom.
You were to tell us tonight what arrangements you'd made for us.
The place of the atom.
It's 8:27. Why are you nervous?
The children creep toward Gordon's desk.
The arrangements, yes. Yes, I'll tell you about those in a few moments. But first of all, I want to finish my lesson. The question of atomic energy.
You're not thinking of atomic energy.
You're thinking of a brick wall.
A brick wall. A brick wall. I must think of a brick wall.
The children glare at him.
Wall. I must think of a brick wall.
A brick wall appears superimposed over his eyes.
Wall. Brick wall. I must think of a brick wall. It's almost 8:30. Brick wall.
Sweat pours down his face. The wall begins to crumble. The children's eyes glow and bricks tumble from the wall. Behind the wall, the faint outline of a clock appears. Gordon closes his eyes. The wall collapses. As the minute hand strikes 8:30, the children's eyes dart to the briefcase on the desk. In a montage, Gordon's dog startles awake. Dr. Willers and the vicar look up at the sound of the blast. In the car, Anthea and Alan gape at the schoolhouse as a raging fire consumes it from within. Anthea closes her eyes and solemnly lowers her head. In a close-up of the fire, pairs of small glowing eyes appear in the rising flames, then drift one by one toward our view. The end. Closing titles appear over the burning schoolhouse. Cast: George Sanders as Gordon Zellaby, Barbara Shelley as Anthea Zellaby, Martin Stevens as David Zellaby, Michael Gwynn as Alan Bernard, Lawrence Naismith as Dr. Willers, The Villagers, Richard Warner as Harrington, Jenny Laird as Mrs. Harrington, Sarah Long as Evelyn Harrington, Thomas Heathcott as James Paul, Charlotte Mitchell as Janet Paul, Pamela Buck as Millie Hughes, Rosamund Greenwood as Miss Ogle, Susan Richards as Mrs. Plumpton, Bernard Archard as the Vicar, Peter Vaughan as P.C. Gobby. The children: June Cowell, John Kelly, Leslie Scobble, Roger Malick, Teresa Scobble, Peter Taylor, Linda Bateson, Carla Cura, Mark Milan, Elizabeth Munden, Peter Prydell, and Howard Knight.